You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate and Ed Legg continue their discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year, with a look at what was happening in the dance clubs, electro, freestyle, high energy, Madonna and Jelly Bean, and the beginnings of house. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. Or should I say 80s roll? That's right. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox. Welcoming back once again the Freebird Yeller himself, Ed Legg, to continue our discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year. This chapter focuses on the New Music Seminar in New York City, August 6th through 8th, 1984. But really, this is the dance music chapter. Ed, were you hitting the clubs in 84?
You know what? The only time I ever walked into disco was the last week of 1983 in Dallas, Texas, and the middle of early July 1984 in Tampa. And it was the same disco. It was called Confetti's. So
Confetti's.
The answer is yes.
Well, the fact that you're calling it a disco when it was dance music.
You're right. And it wasn't. You're exactly right. And you know what? It was rock. It was rock. It was what this chapter talks about, because it was playing rock songs like I Want a New Drug, a song by that band Survivor that did Eye of a Tiger, but not that song. And there's something else. I mean, it did Billie Jean, of course. There was something else that I'm gapping on, but they were rock songs. And to this beat, and it talks about it in this chapter, how they producers started gauging it like that.
Yep, they were remixing. They were remixing remixing rock songs for the dance clubs. It was all coming together. Yes. Matos has a great quote that I just got to read. He says, "If pop radio in 1984 was enacting a fantasy of racial, sexual, and social integration that seemed to be running in the opposite direction of Reagan's increasingly separatist early 80s, it was only catching up with the clubs." And that's the moral of this chapter, that the clubs were really putting music and cultures into a blender. All kinds of things were going on. I feel like historically, like looking back from the perspective of 2023, this is one of the most important chapters in the book as far as influence on future things. But it's interesting because there was so much going on. There's a blend of, like you say, rock or dance-oriented rock songs. Like Owner of a Lonely Heart was number two.
Yes, that's the other song that was planned. I don't know how I forgot that.
And we've already talked about that because Trevor Horn produced that. He also produced Trevor Horn of the Buggles' Video Killed the Radio Star and once an alumni of Yes, but he'd already quit Yes by this point. But he was also producing Frankie Goes to Hollywood that year. We talked about that, I think, in the first chapter of the book. But this time, Matos points out that Cashbox had debuted their 12-inch charts. And for those who don't remember the vinyl era, a 12-inch, there were two kinds of 12-inches. There was the long player, which was you had a whole album on a 12-inch piece of vinyl, or you had what they called a 12-inch, which was a 12-inch single. And that was just one song stretched out over the whole foot of vinyl, and you got much bigger bass response. So we talked in the Techno Roll series how that was kind of an accidental discovery, because one of the first disco remixers was looking for 7 inches to print up some dance records. They didn't have any, so they printed them up on 12-inch vinyl, and the rest is history. Once he heard the bass response on a 12-inch single, he was like, this is what I want. And that became the standard. So by 1984, 12-inch singles are definitely the industry standard for dance music. And it's interesting that the charts that week, that Owner of a Lonely Heart was at number 2. Run DMC's Hard Times, which is their second single, was number 3. And it's interesting. And I think that has more to do with marketing. I don't see Run DMC as dance club staples, but they were selling on 12 inches, you know, for that bass response. And number 1 was Shannon's Let the Music Play. And this is a really important song because it's right where electro, which we've talked about on many episodes of Techno Roll, and we talked about in this series on the hip hop chapter. But Afrika Bambaataa's Planet Rock, co-produced with Arthur Baker, starts a subgenre called electro, which is, I guess, hip hop's first subgenre. And Shannon is where hip hop or electro turns into freestyle. That once it becomes song oriented, especially with Latina singers, it becomes what's known as freestyle or Latin freestyle. That's the dominant style. And our own Steph Haynes wants to tell us about Shannon's Let the Music Play. Steph, share some of the insights.
Well, when this song came out, I was a kid. I was about 12 or 13. So the first place I heard it was on the radio. It was big at school dances. But what was awesome about this song is it had a lot of staying power. Because a few years later, I want to say I was 16, I got my first fake ID. I grew up in another time. So, you know, you grow up in Brooklyn, you get fake IDs when you're a teenager. It's not to drink, it's to go dance in the clubs. And that's what I did. I would go with my older cousins to the clubs. And one of the first things you could always count on playing 3-4 years after this thing was released was Shannon's Let the Music Play. And it would get the biggest pop. That song would come on. If there was no one on the dance floor, that song came on. Everybody was on the dance floor. It stayed in the charts. I don't know how long, but I mean, it to this day, like I was telling you before the show, on Valentine's Day, I took my husband to a strip club because we do weird things like that. And it's also our anniversary on Valentine's Day. So it was for me too. I like to look at the ladies too. So anyways, we go out there and the first song that's playing is Shannon, Let the Music Play. That's the very first thing I heard on Valentine's Day when we walked into the club.
That's a classic. 40 years later, they're still playing it in the strip clubs. That tells
well,
you what
that
we're
would
dealing
be 40
with
years later in the strip clubs.
Oh, don't remind me. Don't remind me. But there's a lot of other trends going on. Another sound is what Matos calls the big new club sound of 1984, which is high energy. Again, we did a whole Techno Roll episode on this in the first Techno Roll series. And this is a style that Matos says pointed straight back to disco. And then it was really an update on the synthesizer-driven sound of Patrick Cowley's productions for Sylvester. Now, Patrick Cowley was this genius record producer out of San Francisco who worked with Sylvester from 78 until 1982, when he tragically was one of the early victims of AIDS. He was a victim of AIDS before they even had a word for it. They diagnosed him with cancer at the time. And so Patrick Cowley is one of these undersung geniuses who was massively influential. And around this time, a number of other producers are picking up on what he had laid down in the late 70s and early 80s. And so you've got songs like Evelyn Thomas's High Energy. And then you've got Saw, aka Stock Aitken Waterman, who start out with, You Think You're a Man by Divine. But now Steph reminds me, and I should have done this before I said, I'm going to blame Steph. She should have made me do this before I started talking about High Energy. But let's go ahead and hear Shannon's Let the Music Play, produced and written by Chris Barbosa. That was Let the Music Play by Shannon, produced and arranged by Chris Barbosa. That's the classic moment when electro becomes freestyle. And for corn dogs like myself, who didn't even know what freestyle was until, say, 2 years ago, this is what freestyle is. It's basically electro with a Latina singing, not necessarily only Latinas, but that's the general concept. But as I was saying before Steph made me cue, High Energy was the big new club sound of 1984. It mainly dominated in white gay discos. It wasn't a sound that you heard in a lot of black clubs. It definitely wasn't a sound you heard in a lot of mainstream clubs, but very popular sound at the time, as people like Evelyn Thomas come along with High Energy. And Divine, of all people, comes out with the hit You Think You're a Man, which is produced by Stock, Aitken, and Waterman, aka Saw. And these guys are going to go on to produce Kylie Minogue and Mandy Smith and totally dominate the late 80s British pop scene. And it's also kind of fascinated me because that kind of music, high energy based music, is the dominant pop music form in the late 80s in England, when acid house comes along and revolutionizes as the underground sound and then soon the new popular sound. And for the longest time, I had a hard time telling the difference between, like, what is the difference between high energy and house music? Well, this is the difference. If it sounds like You Think You're a Man by Divine, it's high energy. If it sounds like any number of house songs, then it's house. That's a terrible explanation. But my basic rule of thumb is if it's got expensive high money synthesizers and a really compressed clean sound, it's probably high energy and it's probably Stock, Aitken, Waterman. And if it's got a rawer, cheaper sound, it's probably produced by somebody like Jesse Saunders in their bedroom in Chicago, and it's house. So that much more raw, more simplistic sound is going to be house, whereas the elaborate expensive synthesizers, because in the early 80s, the only kind of synthesizers were super expensive. But they go on to immediately produce You Spin Me Round Like a Record by Dead or Alive, which goes number one in the UK in March 1985. And Saw goes on a run. They end up producing like 13 UK number ones and selling 35 million records. So it's a massively successful formula. And Saw clearly, I mean, by the time it's Kylie Minogue, it's well removed from the gay discos that it started in. But nonetheless, in 1984, it's still rooted in the gay discos. And then he gets into a discussion of Bronski Beat, whose album Age of Consent comes out to quite a bit of critical acclaim. I can remember reading about this record. I wasn't hip enough to be dancing to it in clubs, but it was a very openly gay record. And Matos quotes a radio tip sheet, which he doesn't name. And so I'm very curious which radio tip sheet was ripping Bronski Beat, like kind of backhanded compliment. They're praising the beats and the songwriting, and they're totally condemning the subject matter, which is about being a gay teenager in a small town. So that was kind of interesting. But as we know, Ed, how homophobic were things in 1984?
It's one of the reasons my friend Joel was the only person I knew who went to probably one of the more famous, a very similar club to a four level club in Atlanta called Backstreet that was open 24 hours a day. They served booze 24 hours a day. And my buddy went with a couple of gorgeous heterosexual women who liked to dance without getting hit on. And once he got used to it, he didn't mind being hit on. He just hung around with them.
Yeah, I was doing that kind of stuff later on. Once I discovered that I could get horny dudes to buy me free drinks, and that the clubs were really carded, you know, I would pop into. There was a gay club right next to the punk club, and we would pop in, get drinks, and then be total homophobic a holes ourselves, and you know, I'd not even say thanks for the drinks and run out. But anyway,
there you go.
You know, yep. Yeah, so that's his life. I was a punk and a twerp, and that's what we did. But then he talks a little bit more about Trevor Horn. And like I mentioned, Trevor Horn had produced Yes is Owner of a Lonely Heart, featuring Trevor Rabin as a songwriter and lead singer, and also had produced Relax and Two Tribes by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, which had already sold 6 million copies on 12-inch singles but before the album even came out. And honestly, Frankie Goes to Hollywood to me is those first three singles, and the album, not that I was like – really in the demo, but I can remember friends of mine who were way into the Frankie Goes to Hollywood singles being pretty let down by the album, and we didn't hear a lot about Frankie Goes to Hollywood after that. So a kind of a three-hit wonder package. But Trevor Horn was a keynote speaker at the New Music Seminar that year, which is fitting. And then he goes into the history of the New Music Seminar, which had been started in 1980 by Tom Silverman of Tommy Boy Records, who's going to, you know, get rich and famous producing or just releasing Planet Rock by Afrika Bambaataa, but also Mark Josephson of Rockpool Magazine, which was not only a magazine for DJs, but it was also a DJ record pool. We talked about this in the Techno Roll series, where if, you know, DJs need a lot of records to play them. They want them to be cheap or free. If you want DJs to play their records, you need to get them copies. And this is, of course, back before digital distribution. But so they had what they called record pools, and DJs could sign up, and then the record companies would make sure the record pools had plenty of copies of the 12 inches they wanted out there to the DJs, and they would distribute them to the DJs. So there was a whole network of getting the DJs the latest and greatest club songs, and that was how it was done. A New Musical Seminar looked at the industry from the perspective of DJ. So pretty interesting, pretty pivotal thing. And New Music Seminar ends up getting surpassed by South by Southwest in the 90s, but in the 80s, it was absolutely miles ahead, the number one music seminar in the business. But let's go ahead and hear a little bit of High Energy. This is Saw's You Think You're a Man, as sung by Devon. And that was Divine singing You Think You're a Man, written and produced by Stock Aitken Waterman, a.k.a. Saw. And this is a song I first heard by the Vaselines, which is a band I first heard of when Nirvana covered a couple of their songs, Jesus Don't Want Free for a Sunbeam, on their Incesticide compilation. So I went out and bought the Vaselines album, and they had done a cover of Divine's You Think You're a Man, and I had no clue. I just thought, this is a little bit different from their other songs. So, again, apologies for being a corn dog, but you know, that's what I am. I was completely oblivious.
What was the demographic at this point? What by 84? What was the demographic for these clubs? It clearly was moving from white gay men, correct?
Well, there were different clubs. There were clubs like Heaven in London and clubs in San Francisco and another club in New York that were totally aimed at white gay men. And they were big enough.
Backstreet was too. Backstreet was in Atlanta originally as well. Exactly. Yeah. But then it changed.
Yeah. And so High Energy basically stays in those kind of clubs. And then because of Saw, turns pop. And kind of has a parallel history. I wouldn't want to say it stops being dance music. Well, By the time it's Kylie Minogue, it does stop being dance music. It's just pop, which is a totally normal evolution. But I was actually asking some dance authorities on Twitter how that today, how high energy fit in with house, and electro and the other things going on. And basically that was the consensus, was that it was for white gay guys and it didn't penetrate into the R&B market or the black dance clubs, not even the black gay dance clubs. And it definitely didn't penetrate into the rock oriented dance clubs that we're going to be talking about in a second. So it was kind of just a parallel direction, but massively influential. And also, as we talked about in the high energy episode on Techno Roll, this was the generation of people that were absolutely devastated by AIDS. So, hats off, moment of silence in memory of so many people who died so young and were so despised. I mean, the Reagan administration actively sabotaged attempts to diagnose and treat AIDS early on, and there was a huge amount of hostility and hatred for victims of AIDS up until, Michael Jackson made, I think the kid's name was Ryan White, and other people who were transfusion, who had gotten HIV through blood transfusions, and eventually, and also because of the activism of groups like ACT UP and the AIDS Quilt and other things, gay guys got together and fought for their rights and their rights to be treated like human beings. So in the end, big progress socially, but at a heavy, heavy cost. So it always makes me sad to think about the high energy scene, because so many young, promising, talented, beautiful people with a lot to contribute who got taken out so young. But back to the matter at hand. Now he starts talking about what Matos starts talking about, what he calls the post-punk diaspora, and how rock discos start aiming for that. We've talked about this repeatedly, how punk didn't click in the States. New wave kind of clicked briefly in the States. There's a period, 78, 79, 80, when groups like The Knack and Blondie and the Talking Heads get some radio play, but then that is taken away by the mid-80s. And last week we talked about how X was still bitter about that. But what you did have was these dance clubs that were aimed at rock audiences, and the punk new wave connection was a big part of that. But it also had things like the Paradise Garage, which does feed directly into the modern EDM tradition of Britain. They call it garage, and it's similar to house. Larry Levan and Frankie Knuckles came up together as DJs, but Larry stayed in New York, ran the Paradise Garage, which was totally dominant in this period, and it was influencing pop production, that the metronomic rhythms of the drum machines and the big echoes, because that's how it sounded in the Paradise Garage, massive sound system in that club, and rock producers were hearing that and started copying it. And you also had radio DJs like Frankie Crocker of WBLS, which was the number one black radio station in New York at the time. He was hanging out in Larry Levan's DJ booth at the Paradise Garage and watching out for what he's going to play. And that's where songs like Let the Music Play by Shannon first start come in. But then he also talks about other clubs in New York, like Hurrah's, which was the first New York City club to embrace the, quote, post-disco hybrid of post-punk dance ethos and combine it with giant video screens, which were soon followed by the Mud Club. Heaven and other gay clubs picked up on that quickly. Then he talks about Danceteria, which was, he calls, the video club. And it had just a mega experience, like pretty much like the club you were talking about in Atlanta, except not aimed at a gay audience especially, but it had a concert room for live bands. I know the Butthole Surfers played a legendarily infamous show there, and I want to say 86, maybe it was 87. But you also had a video lounge, then you had a dance floor, then you had a private lounge for private parties, and Danceteria became, I mean, I wasn't even into dance music, but I had heard of Danceteria and fantasized about going there, like, had that kind of cachet that even a hick in Borger, Texas, who has two left feet and doesn't know high energy from freestyle to save his life, is hearing about Danceteria and curious about going there. And they quote Arthur Baker, the co-producer of Planet Rock, is saying that Danceteria had that rock element. And he remixed a lot of rock records and tested them on that dance floor. So he's doing remixes for people like Cyndi Lauper and Bruce Springsteen's infamous Dancing in the Dark. And, it's hitting the radio. So were you at these rock discos, were you hearing a lot of Bruce and Cyndi Lauper in the mix as well?
I can see Cyndi Lauper. I don't think Bruce's album had come out, Born in the USA had come out yet when I was at that. Yes, it had. The only place I ever heard Dancing in the Dark remix with Max Weinberg's drumming turned into a kind of a disco cascade with Gated and all that was on the radio in Columbus, Georgia. It just was the strangest experience. But I will tell you this. When Springsteen was in Atlanta at the end of the year on that tour, on the beginning of that tour for Born in the USA, that he showed up. I mean, it was in the, in the people section or the gossip section that he went dancing one night. And that first video is him dancing with Courtney Cox at the end.
It was
like a parallel universe. So it was like this, and in my rock head, just kind of watched it go by. But, I knew that Bruce, the newly buff Bruce with his headband and everything went out to one of the clubs in Atlanta. The famous more mainstream club, and I use those with quotes, was called Limelight in Atlanta. That was kind of the one that came after Backstreet, and Backstreet survived way longer than the Limelight. But that was the one that I think is more like Danceteria.
I see. And let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. When we come back, we'll talk about radio's relationship to dance music in 1984.
Hey, Pantheon listeners. Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
And so this chapter is another example of the way Matos is so skilled at weaving together a lot of narrative threads. And several figures that we've already talked about from the first chapter on radio have come back. Like we talked about Trevor Horn, he's back. We talked about Tom Silverman before, he's back. And now we're going to talk about Larry Berger of WPLJ. He's the guy at the beginning of the book who turned his album-oriented rock station into a contemporary hit station. And the slogan was the future of pop radio. But he admitted at an NMS seminar session that year that, quote, we don't break a lot of records. And the way he expressed it is, you know, we want to play popular records that are already hits. We don't want to be forcing things down people's throats. But it just speaks to the conservatism that was already creeping into what at the time was pop radio's most adventurous format, the contemporary hit radio. And one of the reasons why 1984 is kind of an outlier, and by 85, 86, 87, you're getting diminishing returns in the pop scene. You still have a lot of cool things going on in the underground scenes in hip hop and metal and punk and in dance and country for that matter, but the pop radio definitely pinnacles in 1984 because we have this brief window when the formats are a little bit open to new things and not yet completely ossified. He also quotes Ken Barnes of Radio and Records, which is another radio tip sheet, who was grumbling at the lack of quote unquote outsiders participating in the radio panels. Like basically new music seminar was full of DJs and dance producers who constantly grumbled about not getting on the radio. And Ken Barnes was mad that they weren't on his panel so they could have the debate right there. Maybe it was a missed opportunity, hard to say. But, and then they talk about another famous club at the time, the Fun House. And this, he references Arthur Baker again because there's a famous video for New Order's Confusion, which shows Arthur Baker and New Order bringing their new 12-inch single to the famous DJ Jellybean Benitez to test at the Fun House. And then he goes into the whole thing about New Order before he goes back to talk about Jellybean. New Order is the group that rose from the ashes of Joy Division. Joy Division, of course, one of the leading post-punk bands of 78, 79, 80, ended when their leader Ian Curtis hung himself on the eve of their what would have been their first American tour. But the rest of the band, Bernard Sumner, who was going by Albrecht for some reason at this point, also Peter Hook and Stephen Morris, the original rhythm section of Joy Division, joined by Sumner's girlfriend Gillian Gilbert on keyboards, they reform as New Order, keeping a perfect record of fascist-aligned names, Joy Division having been named for a Nazi enforced prostitution unit, and New Order being Hitler's whole agenda. So I don't know what to make of that necessarily. I think it was just bad taste, but you know, maybe they're fascists. I don't know. But New Order is kind of the definitive, one of the definitive British synth dance bands, synth pop bands. And it talks about the spring 1983 release of Blue Monday, which is one of the definitive singles of the era, came out at the same time as their Power, Corruption, and Lies album. Of course, they did that British thing of not putting the hit single on the album. I can remember being really mad when I bought Power, Corruption, and Lies and it didn't have Blue Monday on it. As I recall, it didn't have any song listing on the sleeve, but I had heard Blue Monday both on the radio and in the record store. And I believe even The Clerk steered me to Power, Corruption, and Lies. But anyway, perfectly good album. It just didn't have the money on it. But Matos calls it the British Planet Rock and notes that it was the best-selling 12-inch in history, but that the band lost money on every copy because the packaging was so elaborate. And by the time they figured out they were losing money on it, on every single copy, they'd already sold 250,000 copies. So... Yeah, and we've talked about Factory Records before on Let It Roll, and not one of the most a brilliant record label, but made some really bad business decisions, and that's right up their alley. They also co-founded the Hacienda Club in Manchester, based on Danceteria. And Steph, do you want to jump in and talk about New Order, Blue Monday, and Confusion?
Oh, sure. I was just going to note that. That's an excellent comparison that Matos made there to calling it the Planet Rock. That's a great comparison. As far as Blue Monday, again, it's another one of those songs with staying power. Ditto for Confusion. The staying power of Blue Monday. When I first heard that, again, I heard it on the radio. I was a kid. When I learned to appreciate it was several years later in a club. Again, with a fake ID, but it had staying power 4 or 5 years later. It was still being bumped in the club like it was brand new. Same thing with Confusion. Now, with Blue Monday, it was so popular that like 15 years later, it got remade and that one charted again when Orgy remade it. I like the New Order version better. But Orgy did a good job with theirs. Confusion is the best one, though. Confusion by far is their best work, I think. The crescendo in it, it's just incredible. It takes 40 seconds to build to it. And then when it hits, it goes on for like 2 minutes. It's insane. I loved it. Can't get any better than that.
I picked Blue Monday because I can't stand the singing on Confusion. It just drives me crazy when people can't sing. And they really showed their ass, in my opinion, on the vocals on that one. Yeah. But let's go ahead and hear New Order's Blue Monday. And that was New Order's Blue Monday, the English Planet Rock. Ed, you got any New Order stories to throw into the mix?
Just that I did not know for the longest time that New Order had anything to do with Joy Division or vice versa. I mean, I was completely clueless.
But you'd heard of both?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I remember it. There was a video for one of these songs, and I can't remember which one it was, but I remember seeing it and being surprised that it was English white guys.
What were you expecting?
It was a good dance tune.
So you thought it would be some American black people?
Yes.
I mean, fair enough.
More likely, but I mean that's probably paying myself a compliment. I mean that a lot of this is really over my head because I learned so much from Techno Roll, how this culture just turned into something that just kept going and growing, and nobody ever called up the rock drummer and asked him if it was okay.
They didn't ask your permission. Yeah, they weren't asking mine either.
And the whole time thinking about this chapter this week, I just keep thinking about how it had become so much about going to hear a band and just standing there or sitting there, and that dancing was just not part of the equation. And how many of my friends, I mean, yes, the bands that I played in, we played,
I think we had the one that I was in 10th grade, we had 6 gigs, and I think probably 4 of them were for dances. And then the other ones were just people kind of hanging out drinking. But it just was, it did not compute that this was a good idea, that maybe I should think about. I did know this, that women tended to like to go out and dance. They didn't really want to go just stand there and stare at a band on a bandstand.
Yeah. And that was why we knew they weren't as cool as dudes, right?
Yes. Unfortunately, you're reading my mind at age 19, and obviously there wasn't a lot going on up there.
Yeah, that's where I was too. Completely wrongheaded. And Elijah Waldo, the first interviews I did in the Let It Roll series, his excellent book, How the Beatles Killed Rock and Roll, really goes into that, and how the Beatles had started out as a dance band and were a dance band all the way up, pretty much until Rubber Soul made a conscious decision to go in a folk rock and then the psychedelic rock direction. But by the time of Sgt. Pepper's, nobody's dancing to the Beatles. They're very much listening music, sit down and listen. And rock and roll just followed their lead and abdicated the dance floors. And part of that is the technology. I mean, it became so much cheaper to hire a DJ to play records for people to dance to. And the Beatles were pioneers of going to discos to dance and listen to records. But when they started doing that, their records and the Rolling Stones and the Animals and their peers, along with Booker T and the MGs and James Brown and lots of American R&B, that's what was being danced to. They liked to dance, but somehow when they got into the art rock direction, they just left it behind, and rock and roll, you know, followed that, and disco just completely took the torch of dance music, and rock and roll never got it back. It made a couple attempts with the Manchester sound in the late 80s as a response to Acid House, but that's pretty much it. Other than bands like New Order that basically became dance bands rather than...
Yes, exactly. I didn't think of them as a dance band, because of Joy Division. But and think of what was the Cavern Club? It was a noon rave, basically. Yeah. I mean, why was it sweaty? Why was it nasty? Why was it everything it was? It was a dance club.
Yep. And you know, rock and roll just abandoned the dance audience. Yeah. Jazz had done it before. Jazz did the very same thing when swing turned into bebop. People like Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk, they were so into, hey, y'all, listen to what we're laying down, and you know, abandon the dance force to people like Louis Jordan. And so this is something that happens in music history over and over again. But let's get back to the dance music, and sure. And we'll talk about the freestyle. The king of freestyle at the time is Jelly Bean Benitez, who's one of the first superstar DJs to become a superstar record remixer and producer. Part of this is because of his relationship with a young woman named Madonna, who becomes famous around this time. He remixes Holiday for her. It makes number 16 on the chart. Then he remixes Lucky Star and Borderline. They go top 10. And in no time at all, Jelly Bean and Madonna are no longer an item. Like, they're a couple. They get famous together. And he was famous first from April 1981 to June 1984. He's the DJ at the Fun House, which is one of the top dance clubs in New York City. He'd already DJed at Hurrah and Studio 54, and then goes to the Fun House and evolves the sound. And you know, Madonna, I think Madonna actually had a different celebrity DJ boyfriend when she signed to Sire, when Seymour Stein from his hospital bed signs her, going over the head of Mo Austin, the head of Warner Brothers, who did not want to give Seymour Stein the money to sign Madonna. And Seymour's autobiography talks about how he cut some deal with, I think, Nehushi Erdogan, Ahmet Erdogan's brother, who was running a British division of Warner Brothers at that time, and had to cut some backroom deal to sign Madonna. So the great Mo Austin had an off day when he turned that down. Unfortunately, Seymour Stein didn't listen, because Madonna's going to go on to basically carry Warner Brothers, or go a long way towards carrying them for the next 5, 6, 10 years, 10, 15 years. So, yeah, an interesting mix. Now, had Madonna crossed your radar at all this summer? Or?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because I was hearing her more in Macon, Georgia, where I had a lady friend and was going on the weekends. And on the way, I just remember so many times on the way back hearing those early songs that you just mentioned. And, you know, that was the only choice. There was not a rock station in Macon. There wasn't in Columbus, Georgia either. And so that was, I just remember hearing them. I didn't start liking her until Material World, but I'm getting ahead of things. So, but I certainly knew about her. And that video of Like a Virgin was, you know, impossible not to see once I had MTV.
Yeah, it was colossal. And I made the same mistake. I remember hearing Holiday, and I remember hearing it, I think for the first time, the same road trip that I heard When Doves Cry for the first time. And I can remember going on and on to my brother about how great When Doves Cry was. He was roughly 30 and completely disinterested. I was 13, madly in love with Prince, instant love with Prince. Although I think I'd heard Little Red Corvette the summer before and liked it okay, but When Doves Cry was so obviously different. But Holiday was my counterexample. I was like, and this chick's obviously a no-talent, one-hit wonder. So I was totally wrong. And I kept developing that theory and expanded on it, how Cyndi Lauper was going to run her into the ground, and Cyndi Lauper was the real talent, and Madonna's nothing, and Cyndi Lauper's going to last and have hit after hit after hit. And, you know, Cyndi Lauper's great, but she pretty much had the one hit record, and that was it. And Madonna, of course, goes on to become Madonna. So I couldn't have been more wrong.
I bought Cyndi Lauper's album. I didn't buy a Madonna album ever, and never thought about it, at least then.
Yeah, I stole Like a Prayer from a later girlfriend. I didn't even – Material Girls obviously impressed me as a good album, but I still didn't even imagine buying the album. But again, I had a girlfriend who had it, so I could hear it all I wanted to. And it was on the radio and videos all the time anyway. But right. Yeah. So anyway, I was like Mo Austin. I was wrong about Madonna all the way, and oblivious to Jelly Bean. I had no idea that it existed. I had no idea what freestyle was at all for many, many years. But then Matos segues from there into another city that's going to make a big impact in dance music in 1984. And let's go ahead and hear our next song, and then we'll introduce Chicago and the sound that's coming out of Chicago in the time. And this is Lenoy's Wanna Dance. Wanna Dance by Lenoy's, and the answer is certainly, as I sample Curly Howard from the Three Stooges. And that to me really sums up the difference between house music and high energy and freestyle and also British synth pop, is you can just tell this is teenage kids who got their hands on some cheap ass drum machines and synthesizers and are ripping it up and having fun. And the sound is raw. It's not compressed. It's not cleaned up. It's just raw and funky and wild. And it's going to go on to revolutionize the world. But in July 1984, it's still pretty much contained to the clubs in Chicago. Of course, Frankie Knuckles was working at the Warehouse. He might have already moved on from the Warehouse at that point, but he started out at the Warehouse. That's where the name house music came. It basically initially meant whatever Frankie Knuckles is playing. If you listen to old tapes of Frankie Knuckles shows from the early 80s, pretty much just a disco producer and or DJ, and you'll hear things like Stevie Wonder mixed in there, and it's not what you think of when you think of full blown house. But he was making what they called house music before the producers invented the genre, and this is something that's going to happen again and again a few more times. But Matos uses the Consumer Electronics Conference that happened in Chicago that year to introduce and make that segue. And then he kind of goes through a whole history of Chicago dance music, a compressed history. And he talks about La Mer Viper, which was the first rock disco. And it opened in Chicago in 1978. So the first clubs playing rock music with the modern disco sound system. So like when the Beatles were hearing rock music and discos in the 60s, you're talking about really tinny little AM radio type sound systems. You didn't have the full blown 70s disco sound system until the 70s. And La Mer Viper is one of the first to combine that kind of sound system with rock music. And he also shouts out Wax Trax, which was originally a record store in Denver. Then they expanded to a record store in Chicago. Then they became a record label, initially a punk record label, but they really made their mark with Ministry's Cold Life single in 1982. Sold 10,000 copies right out the gate, which is really good for a self-release 12-inch. Ministry later signs with Arista. It goes on to, pioneer... popularize industrial music, I think would be the way to say it, with their late 80s stuff like Land of Rape and Honey. And then Wax Trax also signed Front 242 out of Belgium. So, a big part of the merger of rock and dance music going on in Chicago coming out of Wax Trax. And there was also Medusa's, which was a teen disco on North Sheffield, opened by Dave Shelton in 1983. He got the nickname Medusa because of his long shocks of blonde hair. Front 242 makes their U.S. debut there at Medusa's in 1984, a week after Ministry had played there. They had a video room on the third floor. And another thing that Matos dropped that I didn't know before this was that there were multiple UHF channels. And if you're old enough to remember UHF, there was two kind of TV frequencies. And UHF what tended to be kind of the left of the dial or the local independent stations if you were in a big city. If you're lucky enough to be in a place that had some UHF channels, you'd get some weird, crazy stuff. And there were multiple UHF channels that went all video in Chicago, which drove sales of Cyndi Lauper and Billy Joel and the Black Neighborhoods. And it's interesting. I just got a piece of fan mail yesterday from a listener. And he's a Black dude who was a big Michael Jackson fan. And he said that one of the byproducts of MTV playing Michael Jackson and Prince was that opened his eyes to white music, that for him, he described it, Cyndi Lauper, as flyover country prior to that. Like he'd heard of her, but he didn't pay any attention to her. But suddenly when he's paying attention to MTV because he wants to watch Michael Jackson and Prince, then he starts checking out Cyndi Lauper and The Fix and ZZ Top and others. And the same thing is going on in Chicago because even for neighborhoods that don't have cable, they've got UHF channels covering video. And I found that to be totally fascinating. Now, you went to pretty much majority Black high school. Did you see any of that kind of crossover? I mean, how many of Black folks that you knew were into white music at all? And did that increase through the 80s?
Well, I was there. I graduated in 78. My brother graduated from the same school in 81, though, and I still knew some kids. And there was still some segregation, but at the same time, really the early 70s was when in like my middle school years is when I remember, and that's when the hit radio, you were still hearing Stevie Wonder as much as Elton John on that's in 73. And the whole time I'm listening to you and thinking about it, in Atlanta, the UHF stations are Channel 17 and Channel 36. And then this was probably no later than 1970. Both of those stations had a Saturday afternoon, and they didn't have videos, but they just had people dance, like bodies just like the silhouette of a body with a psychedelic light show going on TV. for a couple hours. One was called Now Explosion, and the other one, I can't remember what the other one's called, but Channel 17 is not really famous for this, but Channel 17, the UHF station in Atlanta, is what Ted Turner turned into TBS.
Yeah, famously. I mean, famously.
And he would, when he first, in those days, he would come on and do a commercial showing you how to put a, turn a coat hanger into a better UHF antenna.
That's classic.
Ted himself.
You know, one of the other big cable channels when I first got cable, TBS is one of the big ones, but Chicago's WGN was too. I wonder if they were UHF as well.
I bet you're right.
Classic cable channels of the 80s. But anyway, back to the house music. And so he talks about Vince Lawrence, who's a young black kid who's a New Order fan, and produces a song under the name Z Factor, produces Fast Cars in 1983. He's a Frankie Knuckles acolyte. He's dancing at the warehouse. And that was the song that made an impression, but it's not considered house music yet. It wasn't until Jesse Saunders produces On and On that for whatever reason, that is considered the first house music record, even though house music was already being played by Frankie Knuckles, like the way Frankie Knuckles remixed disco and Euro disco and electronic dance album records and including British New Wave. He was making it house music, but it wasn't until Jesse Saunders produces On and On that you get that same effect on record. Because Frankie Knuckles had a drum machine that he would play along with the records. And Ron Hardy, who was his big rival across town, was also doing the same thing. And then guys like Farley Keith and the Hot Mix 5 were doing it on the radio in Chicago. But eventually, Jesse Saunders makes On and On. And that was even a remix of a record by a group called The Chosen Few, which was headed up by Wayne Williams, who later goes on to become R. Kelly's A&R man. And there's a great quote Matos has from Marshall Jefferson, who's yet another early house producer, who calls On and On, quote, the single most important record of the 20th century, because it let the non-musician know he could make music. And I think that's the moral of the story of house. I would obviously quibble with him about the most important record of the 20th century. I think maybe the most important record of the 1980s, but, you know, that's a quibble. Like, there's all kinds of Louis Armstrong records or Duke Ellington records or Bing Crosby records that I, you know, Elvis Presley records, Chuck Berry records that I would argue, Little Richard records I would argue were more important for the whole century. But I think Marshall Jefferson was definitely on to something, because as cool and funky as, you know, high energy was, and as the British synth pop was, it really wasn't until the tech got cheap enough to fall into the hands of black teenagers making records in their apartments that shit really hit the fan and really went crazy. And one last story before we got to go, because we got to talk about Larry Sherman and Trax Records, who's just one of the great record company grifters of all time. Like, the guy owned the only pressing plant in Chicago. And so these kids start bringing these records in. As soon as he notices that they're selling, he forms a record company, quote unquote, partners with these kids, cuts all the most exploitative deals, and is famous for melting down old copies of the Bee Gees, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Yeah. And making new records, so that sometimes you'd get chunks of the label of the Sgt. Pepper's album in your Trax record tracks. But that just classic stuff. And the last bit he talks about is this epic panel they had at the New Music Seminar. Get this lineup. They had Afrika Bambaataa, James Brown, George Clinton, Joe Ely from Austin, kind of an outlier there. You've got Robert Gohl of DAF, the German dance band. You've got Nona Hendrix. You've got Andy Cody Mundy Hernandez of Kid Creole and the Coconuts, which was a band that was definitely being pushed and hyped, never quite made it through. Deborah Yall of Romeo Void, which had a hit single at the time. You had Madonna. You had John Oates of Hall & Oates. You had Lou Reed of the Velvet Underground, who at this point in time is in a deep career lull. He's about to have a comeback in a couple of years. You got Fred Schneider of the B-52s and Peter Wolf of the Jay Giles Band. And just classic tales here. George Clinton baits James Brown into a splits contest and then beats him at it. You know, then they talk about how James Brown had segued into, or they, Matos talks about how he had segued. Basically, he had aged out of the Chitlin circuit, of the R&B circuit, and started working these rock dance clubs. And First Avenue in Minneapolis was one of the places where he went. He went over great with the fans. The club owners hated him because he extorted $1,000 cash out of him while the crowd was yelling for him to go on. But, you know, those are the lessons you learn on the Chitlin circuit. And then he talks about the Unity album that Bambaataa and James Brown did together. And then he talks a little bit about Bambaataa as an eclectic hip-hop DJ. We've covered that. This is the guy who introduced the Monkees, Mary Mary, Kraftwerk's Autobahn, Aerosmith's Walk This Way, the Beatles, so many songs he introduced into the hip-hop lexicon, as well as, you know, being a master of Sly Stone and James Brown and all that. But then his next collaboration is World Destruction, where he worked with producer Bill Laswell, and he wanted the singer from Def Leppard, but Laswell suggested Johnny Rotten, and the rest is history. Matos also mentions that George Clinton had one of his last hits with Atomic Dog in 1982. And then he works in Peter Wolf's Lights Out album, which was his first solo album after leaving the Jay Giles Band, produced by Michael Johnson, who's the brother of Maurice Starr, who goes on to produce New Edition. Had you noticed Peter Wolf's whole segue into dance-oriented music?
I did not. Was it dance? I mean,
I love
Jay Giles Band. I mean, like, they're one of my favorite bands of the 70s.
What did you think of Freeze Frame?
I bought it and did not like it. So I didn't like it that much. The way that Hammond organ, that howling, I mean, I like that single, but I was just sucked in by the single. And, you know, I'm an old Jay Giles. I've become an old Jay Giles appreciator because they were, so I saw them in 76, like a month before my Freebird yelling moment with Skinner. And they were one of the best bands I'd seen.
I've heard that.
They just killed it. And I think Peter Wolf, it kills me that, and I mean, I'm a bearded dude. So they all look so cool in those days, you know, and they kind of look like gangsters, white gangsters. And I mean, what an incredible group, including I wonder who said bullshit to James Brown, though. I'd love to know who said that, because there wouldn't be music that they enjoyed if James Brown hadn't come along. And all I would do if I saw James Brown at this point, at least, would be to bow.
Yeah, I think it might have been Prince who saw him at First Avenue and said he was washed up.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah. But, you know, if anybody's going to kill the king, it's going to be Prince. I mean, that's just a classic, that's just a classic sort of Mike Tyson beating up Larry Holmes kind of moment, you know. You feed the old lions to the young lions, and that's
true.
What happens. And that's what
happens. What did you think of Freeze Frame? What did you think
of? I loved the video. It was, days when I would get the Sears catalog, and it would be a sacred moment in my adolescence. So the dirty video of Freeze Frame was something I've looked forward to. That and Girls on Film by Duran Duran, neither of which I saw as much as I wanted to. But I bought the album, and again, I didn't like the album very much, and I was oblivious to the 70s stuff of Jay Giles Band. So I was oblivious. But that's pretty much it for this episode of 80s Roll. For Ed Legg, I'm Nate Wilcox. We'll be back next week to continue our discussions of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year. And next week, we're going to the Olympics, and we're going to be discussing the dreaded slash wonderful Lionel Richie, Kenny Rogers connection. So that ought to be fun. The 80s are not just hip, cool dance music and great hip hop and punk rock. It's also the year of Lionel Richie and Kenny Rogers. So we'll be diving into that next week.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate welcomes Kim Mack to talk about Living Color. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.